Millions, and it didn't really get much attention here, but this has been going on for a number of years.
And the mosque.
And it's clear that the U.S. has hit this mosque, and a number of investigations have showed that these are civilians, that there was, if there were high-ranking members of al-Qaeda, as the U.S. claims, there are also dozens and dozens of civilians there.
And we clearly have so much more to talk about, and we will, right after this broadcast ends, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. Anand Gopal is a journalist and fellow at the Nation Institute, recently returned from the Middle East, has extensively reported from the region, author of No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. That does it through our show. We'll be broadcasting live from the March for Science on April 22nd, Earth Day, in Washington from 10 to 3 Eastern Time in the day. Same time next week, April 29th, the People's Climate March in Washington from 10 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. Check out democracynow.org for details. And the Democracy Now! Speaking tour is starting this weekend. We'll be at Wesleyan University. We'll be in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'll be throughout Vermont, and we're going across the country from there. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
It is 5 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland, and up next is Democracy Now!
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some.
Dearly beloved,
yes, we are going to dance and celebrate the life and music of Prince. Be sure to tune in this Thursday just before midnight. We'll be joining up with Jeff from the Song Circle to commemorate the one-year anniversary of Prince's passing. Right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And don't forget to come ride with Diablo on Prince's birthday during Petalpalooza. More information on the KBOO website and the community events. Prince forever, Prince all night long.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Real Cool Jazz film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Molly Blues, will play Thursday, April 20th at 7 p.m. The West African country of Mali is a birthplace of the blues. Today, the music and musicians of Mali are in grave danger as fundamentalist Islam and Sharia law become more widespread, dance and secular music are prohibited, musical instruments are destroyed, and musicians are forced to flee their homeland. The documentary, Molly Blues, follows four artists who are using their music to stand up to extremism and inspire tolerance and peace. Again, that's Molly Blues, Thursday, April 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from ADX, a collaborative hub offering access to shared wood, metal, screen printing, jewelry, and digital design shapes through digital design shops through a monthly membership program. The ADX Makerspace Learning Center and Fabrication Shop allows people to bring their ideas to life. Open every day at 417 Southeast 11th in Portland and at adxportland.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll take a look at Portland's involvement in converting human waste to renewable energy.
KBOO's Zelos Marchand will talk with Portland Underground Grad School's Melissa Melko about permaculture.
And we'll take a look at the manure spill in Tillamook Bay. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 20th, 2017. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. It's not just oil spills that threaten our rivers and streams. Officials with the Oregon Department of Agriculture say Tillamook Bay is temporarily closed due to massive spill of liquid manure. Wim Matthews, manager of the AG Department's confined animal feed operation, known as CAFO, says the estimated 190,000 gallons of manure that went into the bay came from the Tony Silvera dairy after the valve on an above-ground storage tank broke. The liquid manure traveled through three other properties before it reached a drain, which dumps into the Tillamook River. From that point, it flows into the bay. The Tillamook County Health Department also closed the bay to recreational shellfish and harvesting. Under CAFO regulations, discharges may be subject to fines and other penalties.
As the saying goes, one man's garbage is another man's treasure. The Portland Bureau of Environmental Protection is taking this statement to heart by releasing a plan to turn the methane produced from human solid waste into clean gas. This project is projected to earn the city around $3 million to $10 million in funds and provide enough gas to run 154 garbage trucks for a year. The BES awarded Northwest Natural Gas a $2.9 million contract to install and operate a fueling station and to distribute the fuel to potential buyers. The plan that was unanimously approved by the Bureau's board and is slated to be in full swing by the end of 2018 with a price tag of around $9 million for the new facility. A lot of the methane gas produced is currently used to run electricity on-site, and about 23% of the methane is burned off. This would essentially be closing off the waste loop.
Spring is in the air, along with a renewed interest in old ways of growing things. Permaculture is the technique of planting things that grow slow but yield big and for longer periods of time. KBOO's Zelos Marchand spoke with Melissa Melko of Portland Underground Grad School to find out more.
So how long have you been with pugs?
Well, this is the third class I'm teaching with them. I started by teaching a class in the fall about local ecology and botany.
Awesome. Have you been involved with botany long?
Yes, I have been working in the horticulture and landscaping business since I was a teenager. And I've been in Portland for 10 years, and I've been doing landscape design and restoration ecology and teaching about plants and gardening.
That's incredible. Restoration ecology. Can you go into that a little more?
Sure. I think of it as earth repair. There's a lot of ecosystem disturbance that humans are continually causing, and a lot of that has resulted in a decline in diversity, and people are hearing a lot about invasive species problems, and there's a lot of ways that we can work with the landscape to try to bring it back to a more diverse and healthy and productive state. So a lot of the restoration ecology work I do in the city is restoring small sites, like maybe people want to create some habitat in their yard. And then I also work in rural areas for landowners and farmers who want to create pollinator habitat or other kinds of restoration work.
Cool. There's been a lot of news coming through our newsroom about permaculture, about better ways that each of us can create a more sustained food environment, even though the cycles might be longer. Does that involve something like that, restorative gardening and botany?
Yeah, permaculture is really the heart of what I do. It's looking at the garden or the landscape as a system that humans are part of. We tend to forget, but we are part of nature. And if we look at how all the different parts of the system are interacting with each other and affecting each other, just seeing that everything is connected and taking that into account when we're making decisions, about land use. It can be, those types of patterns can be applied to a home garden or a yard or to a bigger city, a farm or even a city or even a business. So it's a pretty exciting way to think about things.
That is really exciting. One aspect I think people really want to know about permaculture is, how are there varying, is there a varying length of cycles? If they plant something, is it going to render a harvest within a year? You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of people are interested in it and what that means, but then they go, oh man, I hear that takes like 7 years before it's sustainable.
Yeah.
What's your advice to people who are a little permaculture shy?
Well, one of the permaculture principles is start small and build on success. And another one of them is get a yield. So you might plant a fruit tree that isn't going to bear fruit for 5, 6, 7 years, but there's lots of things you can do right outside your doorstep right now to start getting a yield. And those are some of the things you should start with. And permaculture is also based on the fact that we need to observe and respond to natural conditions. So while you're observing your site and planning, you can do small things to get a yield. Like, for instance, if you put out some little container plantings with arugula or lettuce seeds right now, in 30 days you will have salad. That's a pretty good turnaround.
And tasty, too. Tasty turnaround.
Well, the main idea is that nature's all around us in the city, and sometimes we don't see all of that greenery, but we can get to know those plants that are around us and how they're functioning in the ecosystem. Some of them might be useful, for instance, medicinal or edible. And so it's really a plant ID class of, like, what is all that green stuff out there? We're going to be learning 12 major plant families. And once you know the patterns of the families, it's a lot easier to start figuring out what different plants are and what their characteristics might be. So, for instance, right now there's a lot of plants that are really showy in the rose family, like all of the cherries and plums, and soon we'll be seeing apple blossoms and pear blossoms. And so that will be one of the plants we look at the first week and identifying what the patterns that show that those things are all related are.
That's neat. Does that involve mushrooming as well? I know that's kicking up into gear this spring, too.
Right. Well, we're focusing mostly on the plant side of things, and we won't be getting too much into the fungus group. But, of course, plants and funguses are very interconnected. They have mutually beneficial relationships, so it might come up.
Oh, it's like symbiotic in a way? Like, if there's one of a plant is growing, then maybe a mushroom will go next to it?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Plants depend on funguses to interface between them and the roots.
Oh.
They're, and everything that's in the soil to get all the water and nutrients that they need.
It works that they're like best friends then.
Yes, they are. Fungi are best friends.
Do you have a favorite plant family, or I think this stems into, like, what kind of green thumber, what kind of permaculture are you? You have favorites?
Oh gosh, I have a lot of favorites. I love perennial edible plants, things that you can plant and they just keep coming back every year and giving you food for not very much work. The ones that are really well known are rhubarb and asparagus. But I have a lot of other greens in my yard that I grow that are perennial, and then fruit and berries are mostly perennial plants too. And I love our native edibles, like the blue elderberry and the evergreen huckleberry. They're really tasty and medicinal and multifunctional in the landscape. They have something for pollinators, something for birds, and lots for people. So those are the kinds of plants that I like, plants that do a lot of different things.
That's awesome. I feel you. I don't like a lot of sass for my plants. I like it nice and easy.
Sometimes things don't work out and you have to try something different.
Well, thank you so much for making time to talk to me and talk to our audience. And
cool. I appreciate it so much.
You bet. I appreciate it. All right. Well, I'll let you go. You have an awesome afternoon.
You too. Thank you.
the state of Arkansas is trying to clear the path for the execution of two men tonight, Stacy Johnson and Lydell Lee, both of whom have yet to receive DNA testing of evidence in their cases. Out of the original eight men who were slated to be executed during an 11-day period, four have been granted stays of execution. Arkansas, which has not executed anyone since 2005, is trying to use the remainder of its drug midazolam before it hits its expiration date at the end of April. This drug in particular is meant to render the victim unconscious during the death process, but has many times proven ineffective. As was the case with Clayton Lockett, who died 43 minutes after his injection and was said to be writhing in pain, attempting to get up and speak. Drug companies that distributed another drug, Vercurionium bromide, which is used in the deadly cocktail, have been trying to stop the executions because they say they were misled as to how the state was going to use the drug.
It's 5:15, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Of all the people suffering economic pain today, who should get priority attention from the new president and Congress? Regular folks in our country say that those on the lower rungs of the economic ladder, the poor and downtrodden working class, ought to be the priority. But then, regular folks don't run Congress or Trump's White House. The Donald's working class voters must be stunned to see that his top economic priority is not them, but a tiny group dwelling in luxury at the very tippy top of the ladder, Wall Street bankers. Rather than pushing an urgently needed FDR-style jobs program, Trump and company are rushing to aid the richest Americans at the expense of the working class, actually proposing to unleash the banksters to defraud and gouge workaday people. For example, they want to save the poor financial giants from a consumer protection called the fiduciary rule. If you've got a 401k retirement plan, chances are it's managed by a firm of financial advisors. So this rule simply requires them to act in your best interest rather than shifting your money into risky investments that pay them bigger commissions. Prior to the enactment of this ethics provision in 2015, many advisors were serving themselves, gleefully ripping off their customers, mostly ordinary working families, to the tune of $17 billion a year. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's immoral, but it's real money. So the industry has been lobbying hard, but unsuccessfully, to kill the legal requirement that money advisors deal honestly with clients. Now, however, they've got a president who appreciates dishonest business dealings and is going all out to liberate them from the shackles of ethics. Hallelujah, shout Wall Street's bankers. Free at last, free at last. Thank Donald Almighty, we are free at last to gouge consumers.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. California's Labor Commissioner is ordering XPO Logistics to repay more than $850,000 in stolen port trucker wages to four Port of Los Angeles Long Beach drivers. The workers were illegally misclassified as independent contractors instead of as what they are, employees. Jose Herrera is one of the drivers whose wages were stolen by XPO.
The Labor Commissioner issued an order that XPO owes me alone $279,415.83. The total awarded for me and the other three drivers is $855,285.62, and more cases are pending in courts.
Herrera says XPO illegally classifies workers as contractors and then deducts business expenses from the paychecks of these workers. The truckers are in a union organizing drive backed by the Teamsters. Herrera says what XPO is doing is illegal exploitation of port truckers, denying them what employees are entitled to.
I have no workers' compensation if I get injured on the job. That means that I have no disability insurance if something was to happen to me. I have nothing. XPO is breaking the law. by exploiting its workforce. Not only is wrong, but it's illegal. As you can see, very expensive.
As IBEW Local 3's strike against Charter Communications Spectrum in New York and New Jersey continues, the company refuses to bargain and is demanding concessions. The giant cable communications company has refused to bargain with IBEW Local 3 for over 2 years. The strike started March 28th. Workers at Charter say the company is demanding many concessions and changes, including ending pension and hospitalization contributions, ending weekend overtime pay, and increased outsourcing power. Roughly 1,800 IBEW workers are striking Charter. They were working under an expired union contract with Time Warner, the employer before Charter bought the company. IBEW says Charter Spectrum isn't providing workers with the tools, resources, and support needed to properly do the work and deliver promised services to customers.
We need a real living wage that allows us to support our families.
A Bloomingdale's union worker speaking at a rally in New York City against a May 1st deadline, the RWDSU at Bloomingdale's in New York is fighting for a fair contract for 2,000 retail workers. That includes commissions on sales that happen online after customer service delivered in the stores. Those commissions are the key demand in the Bloomingdale's labor talks. WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada, online at atu.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6, and at 7 it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of around 70 degrees and a low of 51, and most likely more showers. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it looks to be the same, minus a few degrees here and there, and possibly a bit of thunder. Today in history, in 1826, British caravan leader Major Gordon Lang became the first non-Muslim to reach the legendary scholarly city of Timbuktu in present-day Mali, and thus the first European to cross the Sahara from north to south. He stayed for 5 months, and the day he left the city was strangled to death by Tuareg raiders. Also on this day, the U.S. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1871, which actually suspended the writ of habeas corpus at the request of President Ulysses S. Grant in order to combat the first version of the Ku Klux Klan. The act effectively shut down the Klan until its second iteration spread across the country in the 1920s. The quote of the day comes from Spanish painter and sculptor Juan Miro, who said, "Wherever you are, you find the sun, a blade of grass, the spirals of the dragonfly. Courage consists of staying at home, close to nature, which could not care less about our disasters. Each grain of dust contains the soul of something marvelous."
Brazil is in the midst of labor pushback on the heels of an impeachment that is due in part to legislative retaliation against its leftist president, Dilma Rousseff. The country is in the biggest financial crisis since the 1930s. FSRN's Michael Fox has more.
It's a chilly April evening in southern Brazil. Roughly 24 public employees are gathered in the capital of the state of Santa Catarina to discuss how the country's proposed pension and social security reform could affect them. They're upbeat, but nervous. If not for themselves, then for their co-workers. That's the case for 55-year-old Anderson Loureiro. He's been paying into Brazil's social security system for 36 years, and he's looking to retire, which he can. But if the proposed reform had been in place when he began as a social worker in 1981, he would still have another decade left on the job and a smaller pension to expect at the end. This could be the new reality across Brazil for those who enter the workforce, and many already in it.
A lot of people that started working 20 years ago had an idea of what it would be like when they got to a certain age. And in the middle of the road, the government is changing the rules. What do you do? I have a son who's 25 years old. Well, he's never going to retire.
The reform will affect millions of public sector workers, and labor unions fear it could lead the way to a piecemeal overhaul of state and local pensions across the country. The reform is part of a larger government push to roll back the progressive gains achieved under the Workers' Party that was ripped from office last year in what many here regard as a legislative coup. The ensuing assault on Brazilian labor rights isn't like anything seen in decades.
Even during the dictatorship, they took away our right to expression and freedom of speech and the two-party system. But the attacks against the working class and workers' rights over labor law were not as intense as they are today. Yes, they took away many rights, but not like today.
That's Ana Júlia Rodrigues, the president of the state chapter of Brazil's largest labor federation, the CUT, which has been mobilizing to push back. Last month, more than a million people marched against the reform in cities across the country. The organizing seems to be paying off. Shortly after the March protests, President Michel Temer announced that the reform would only apply to federal employees, and more concessions have been promised in a move to win over the public and reluctant legislators. Although Brazil's conservative Congress is largely in sync with President Temer, pension reform has proved to be complicated. The legislation is unpopular, and Temer's approval rating has fallen to only 10%. But powerful proponents are pushing for the reform. Artur Maia is the congressional representative in charge of the legislation. He says that future workers won't be able to cover the cost of retirees and that regulations are necessary to save the system from disaster. It's an argument that may sound familiar in many countries where Social Security reform has come up. But unlike in the U.S., the retirement age in Brazil is significantly younger due to a much lower life expectancy.
People today retire very early, at age 50 or 55, and they receive their retirement for longer, sometimes than they even contributed to the system. Naturally, Social Security can't continue like this.
But according to lawyer Luis Fernando Silva, there's plenty of evidence that the current system is more than sustainable. He's an advisor to the Federal Public Employees Union, Sintrafesc, and he believes the reform is actually a move to gut pensions enough so that workers look for other options.
This whole reform is just to incentivize privatization without calling it privatization. It doesn't mention the issue of privatization. Instead, it naturally pushes people away. People are going to migrate into the private sector.
Regardless, labor is readying for the fight. Nine central labor unions are calling for a national strike on April 28th, which they hope will send a strong message to Brasilia. If it is successful, will be the largest nationwide labor protest in Brazil since 1996. A vote on the reform is expected within the next 6 weeks. Michael Fox, FSRN, Florianópolis, Brazil.
And now here's Rick Smith with Labor History.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 workers and injuring 17 more. The rig experienced an initial blowout, releasing an uncontrollable flow of oil and gas from the well. Hydrocarbons then ignited, causing the explosion and fire. It caused a massive offshore oil spill of over 4 billion barrels and is considered the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history. British Petroleum was the main operator responsible for the well's design. The drilling contractor, Transocean, owned and operated the rig. A handful of smaller companies were also involved. While company and governmental officials initially argued the explosion was unforeseeable and then subsequently blamed each other, there were warning signs in the months leading up to the deadly explosion. Multiple equipment failures, design deficiencies, poor preventative maintenance, bad engineering decisions, and a chase for profits that emphasized low worker injuries at the expense of process safety all combined to create the disaster. As well, regulations and standards enforcement were weak in an almost total deregulated industry. One phrase used by investigators to characterize the explosion was the normalization of deviance. From workers to managers to executives, none saw the explosion coming. There were dozens of contributing factors, as the Chemical Safety Board investigation noted. They listed 57 key technical, human, and regulatory factors in their 2016 final report. However, engineers had raised concerns about the potential failure of key equipment. Workers were sensitive to the fact that that they could be fired for raising safety concerns that delayed drilling. BP was ultimately found responsible and racked up over $70 billion in fines, cleanup, and settlement costs. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
According to articles in Al Monitor and Haaretz, Israeli settlers on the West Bank attacked Israeli soldiers last week. This is not the first time far-right settlers have attacked the Israeli Defense Forces, but the incidents generally go unreported unless there are injuries. On April 14th, IDF soldiers responded to reports at the Baladim outpost settlement of clashes between Israeli settlers and Palestinians. When they arrived, rocks were reportedly thrown at them by a group of young settlers calling themselves the Hilltop Youth. Palestinian children are routinely arrested, sentenced, and often fired upon with live rounds for similar behavior. Last week's incident at Baladim has thrown into sharp relief the current Israeli government's attitude towards settlements, seen by much of the world as a hostile takeover of Palestinian land. Liberal politicians called attention to the attack, stating that, of course, settlers are out of control when they cut down olive trees belonging to Palestinians one day and attack Israeli soldiers the next. Defense Minister Amir Peretz said, quote, "The rioters must be brought to justice," unquote. This is at odds with the reactions of the ruling right wing, which largely ignored the attacks on its own security forces. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is known for his outspoken social media presence on topics ranging from Israeli domestic policy to his own hair color. He has yet to comment on last week's attacks on any platform.
Yesterday, Wednesday, marked the new year for adherents of the Yazidi faith. The homeland of the Yazidis is in traditionally Kurdish areas of northern Iraq. The relatively small pre-Islamic sect has been the victim of a genocidal campaign by the so-called Islamic State since 2014. The sect has been vilified as devil worshippers and persecuted to varying degrees for hundreds of years. Yazidis have been slowly moving back into areas recaptured by the Iraqi army and other forces from the Islamic State. It is the first Yazidi New Year openly celebrated in the area since 2014. However, some Yazidi commentators express worries that the current situation could prove to be even worse than under the Islamic State. The area of northern Iraq they call home is now claimed by the Islamic State, the Iraqi government, the Iraqi Kurds, and the Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK from Turkey. Nevertheless, Yazidis in diaspora across the world celebrated their New Year yesterday, including enclaves as far away as Australia.
Two confidential documents recently leaked from Russian sources describe a plan of Russian government to swing the 2016 U.S. presidential election to Donald Trump and undermine voters' faith in the American electoral system. The documents are the work of a government-run Soviet think tank, the Institute for Strategic Studies. The first document is a strategy paper written last June. It recommended the Kremlin launch a propaganda campaign on social media and global news outlets to encourage U.S. voters to elect a president who would take a softer line towards Russia. The second document, drafted in October, warned that Democratic candidate Clinton was likely to win the election. It argued Russia should end its pro-Trump propaganda and instead intensify its messaging about voter fraud to undermine the U.S. electoral system and damage Clinton's reputation. The documents were central to the Obama administration's conclusion that Russia had mounted a campaign against Clinton.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. If you have a breaking news story or think you might have something, that you're onto something, please call us at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Grace Ann Smith, Poppy Soto Madrid, Sam Bowman, and Tom Flynn. The producer is Celos Marchand. Special thanks to our engineer, Aaron Yonke, the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director. Oh, pardon me. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Flowmith on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Positively Revolting. Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, on Veterans Voice, former Army Airborne Ranger Dave Edgar reflects on his military experiences in Central America in the 1980s. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on RadioZine, a live interview with ex-CIA operative John Kiriakou, who was sent to federal prison for blowing the cover off of the torture scandal at Guantanamo Bay. And at 11:30, Making Contact presents Spies of Mississippi, the true story of a secret spy agency formed by the state of Mississippi to preserve segregation and maintain white supremacy. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO-FM and clicking on Donate.
said Dan Sinclair, a robe and dub, soldier, marching, yes, marching to war, after war, yeah, Dan Sinclair, a robe and dub, soldier, marching, yes, marching to war. Yeah, I'm on a satellite, you're tuning to Dan Sinclair. Keep it locked every time. Let's play a big tune again, me out.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Ori Gallery is the newest art gallery to grace the city of Portland. Its mission is to create a gallery that holds a space for people of color while holding up their brilliant artistry. We have in the studio Layla Hale and Maya Vivas from Ori Gallery. Welcome and thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
What is Ori Gallery at its heart? What's your purpose and your orientation in art?
Well, the word Ori is a Yoruba word meaning head. And for our purposes, Ori is a meditative, decorative practice used to kind of channel our creative energy and reach back into our African roots and, you know, channel the things that are truest to us. And so that's why we named it Ori Gallery.
Yeah.
Does Ori mean head in the sense of like the intellect or the brain or?
The head is in a channel, the thing connecting you to the Orishas, which are the sort of African deities in Yoruba practices. So it's the head meaning the creative is a conduit for the otherworldly or the ethereal.
Yeah.
Right, okay. And what kinds of artists will you feature at the gallery?
We primarily want to focus on queer and trans artists of color. I feel like in the art world, folks, like marginalized folks with those identities tend to get overlooked. And wanting to create a gallery like this, I mean, it's been a lifelong dream of mine personally, as well as Layla. I just want to see myself reflected in the art world because art is something that I love so much. And I just want there to be a place where folks can see other folks like us, you know, like creative people working.
Outside of Black History Month.
Yeah, outside of Black History Month. Yeah.
Total tokenization and cronyism and, you know, wanting us to be seen as who we are and not as some sort of token or like fascination piece or exotic sort of item. That, yes, we're just artists working through the world just like everybody else and we need a space to just be.
Maya, you're a sculptor, is that right?
Yes, I am a ceramic sculptor.
And Layla, are you an artist as well?
Yeah, I'm a tattoo artist and illustrator.
And will you be making tattoos at these?
Absolutely not. I have my own private studio. Okay. I work at a studio in the Southeast. We will be holding workshops and seminars and panels in the space, though. We'll be located on 4038 North Mississippi. It's official now.
And when is the gallery slated to open?
We're looking at November for an open date right now.
Yeah, so in the fall.
And how will the Ori Gallery meet the needs of Portland's visual art community? You pretty much covered it, but if there's anything else you'd like to add on to that.
We'll be filling a wide and deep chasm. But you don't see what we're doing because there's always some other artist who is somehow better qualified, and we know that that's better with quotation marks. And, you know, we're just not represented for the work that we're doing and for how vital our work is to the community. You know, we're not just out here making paintings and doing weird art stuff and, you know, being young ingenues. We're organizing. We're making artwork that's representative of the struggles that our community is going through, and we're using it as a medium to inspire people to get off their butts and be involved with their communities. And I think it's especially important that this is happening in a heavily gentrified neighborhood. Like, folks who have lived in Portland a while know that Mississippi used to be a redline district. It used to be the only place where Black and brown folks were able to purchase homes and own businesses and congregate without being bothered. And we know what Mississippi looks like now. It's heavily gentrified. We have very, very little representation of the folks who live in that neighborhood and make it what it is. And this is our opportunity to take it back and to be loud and belligerent and and make that difference. We can take, you know, we can approach every single business that has a Black Lives Matter sign in their window and ask, do they? How do they matter to you? What are you contributing? What are you doing to step in and use your talents and your privilege for this revolution?
Yeah. Layla, does your work have a kind of a social orientation to it along these lines?
Maya's work does.
Yeah, Layla's a tattoo artist.
I'm sorry.
I feel like it's kind of, that question is kind of interesting to me, because when I make work about my own personal experience as like a Black